It is hour one of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another show about the future. Mrs. Future?
Yes.
You ready?
I am. Good. Got my fingers on the buttons.
We have a very special second hour where we bring in Dr. Vivian Ming, a world-class expert in artificial intelligence.
She is not Ming the Merciless.
No, she has much compassion. If anything, in the sci-fi mythology, she'd be the one to invent the emotion chip.
We hope so. She's definitely one of the AI pioneers. She's looking to create machines that transcend limitations and help humans reach their highest potential. And she's got some very interesting feathers in her cap.
That's right. She doesn't want us to end up on the dustbin of history.
That's right.
Neither do I. So,
co-conspirators.
Yes. So we're going to look at how this new stuff can really be to our benefit.
That'll be the second hour.
Yeah, the second hour. First hour, though, there's a lot of news, a lot of future news that we'd like to cover. Starting with, well, us. We almost had to evacuate from Boulder Creek last week, 1.6 miles from the Bear Fire.
Oh, that's ringside so long seat. Ago.
So long ago, yes. Still going, I might add.
That's true. That's true. It's hot everywhere now. Last week, it was cool. Last week, it was amazing weather. There was zero wind during the heat of the fire, during the time when it could have become completely out of control. We are so blessed. Thank goodness the Cal Fire jumped in there, had 800 people there in the thick of it. I think they're down to just a few hundred now.
But it's under control, so they say. Mm-hmm. This heat feels so dry, and it's almost eerie the way things are so still and hardly any wind. But anyway, it's beautiful. It's nice here down the coast. It's definitely back to paradise.
Yeah.
In terms of other paradises that used to be, and trying to get back to that status, Puerto Rico, interesting article in Tech News about how Apple and AT&T have activated the LTE Band 8 to give iPhone users in Puerto Rico cellular service by Loon Balloon. Loon Balloon.
Loon Balloons.
Yes. Those are the balloons that Google's Alphabet's Loon project, using balloons for carrying telecommunications gear flying over Puerto Rico.
Okay. And are you going to give us the details?
Well, Apple's been working.
Can we all use it?
No.
No.
No. Yeah. No, they've only tested it over Nevada and Puerto Rico so far in the United States.
So it's another channel of connectivity for internet.
Yeah. Band 8 exists in all our iPhones from the 5C forward, and it just needs to be activated. They need to download a little app to make it go.
You mean we have to awaken the monster?
Well,
Band 8 is asleep inside our devices.
That's right. There's a lot of things sleeping in there. Mm-hmm. This is just one of them.
An undisclosed feature, is it?
It is. It is. It's a 900 megahertz antenna in frequency range. That is really nice because 900 megahertz goes through buildings easier and can go through obstructions and travel a further distance.
Isn't that what our home wireless telephones are?
Some of them have been, and the 5.8, 2.4 gigahertz typically these days, but 900 used to be used for video in the old days. The frequencies, each of them have their pros and cons. This one is very useful for, as I said, going through walls and buildings and stuff. And also it's got to travel from the height of a balloon, which is several miles up in the air.
Oh, really? The balloons are flying up? How high?
They fly high, 70,000, 80,000 feet.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they need to be able to pick that up. So as I said, LTE Band 8 is a 900 megahertz band, which means that its range can cover the island more effectively.
It sounds like you said Band-Aid.
Yeah, it is kind of. Band 8. It helps devices reach further cell towers. It distributes the load among the now accessible cell towers that are working.
Sort of extends their range through a mesh network, right?
Yeah. It's a cell phone network. Mm-hmm. It's created a special carrier settings update. you know, that's what you have to do in order to make it go.
You mean you have to have bandwidth to get your phone to have bandwidth?
Well, you need to go to an area where you can download this app to install the program so that you can have 8. Yeah, so you have to get to a place where you have some bandwidth to begin the process. So it's a chicken and egg thing.
There you go, folks. If you're addicted to your iPhone in Puerto Rico, you have to hike to some place that already has bandwidth so that you can get the software that will give you remote bandwidth through this Loon Balloon.
Well, AT&T says it's connected more than 60% of the population already in Puerto Rico, and 90% of the population in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And they've already deployed 17 portable network points and 14 temporary cell sites already. So they're well on their way to making this go.
Now, that's independent of this Loon Balloon? That's just AT&T on their own.
Yeah, that's just AT&T just getting it back again. Mm-hmm. And the Loon Balloon, well, the Loon Balloons, they've never deployed them from scratch at such a rapid pace before. They're really happy to be working with AT&T and other partners. They're able to offer, so far, emergency internet connectivity, mostly texting. They're trying to keep the bandwidth kind of low. The problem is that these are little balloons, right? So they sail on winds in the stratosphere, and they tend to go outside of the range of Puerto Rico. And so they have to figure that out. They've been working with balloons using machine learning algorithms to know where to place them in the atmosphere so they stay for a maximum time over Puerto Rico before they start drifting to other locations over the Caribbean.
Wow, this is crazy. So they're just launching balloons and the balloons work for a little while and then they just go randomly into the atmosphere.
Well, if they
somewhere?
Put them in the right location, they'll stay around for a while. Right, they have to know the weather patterns to be able to really get them to stay where they want them to go.
Huh.
It's a whole art form in and of itself to launch a balloon at the right place at the right time so it stays over the area that you want to have connectivity.
These are just amazing problems they're trying to solve. Keeping a balloon in place.
Yeah.
I mean, typically you do that with a weight and a string.
I guess they could tether them, right?
I guess
they could tether balloons, but tethering them on a several-mile tether is a bit much. Anyway, they're working on it, and it looks like they're getting some pretty good connectivity. It seems to be working, and it will keep you posted as this evolves. It's looking good. So that's the update on Project Loon over Puerto Rico and Apple's new...
And 8. Band-8. We'll be right back, Dr. Yes. Future Show. Stay tuned.
Speaking of being glad to be here, I did run into this story I haven't even told you about yet, Mrs. Future.
Oh,
I think I'll mention
I'm
it really
so
briefly
glad to
here.
Be here.
The headline reads, Einstein's theory of happiness sells for $1.3 million at an auction.
What is that? Is that an essay?
Well, it's a relative theory, I'm sure.
Uh-huh. Anyway,
the scientist's musing was a handwritten note, and it's not as famous as his theory, of course, and relativity, but it kind of shed some light on his mind. The Wiener's auction house said Einstein scribbled the note in German to a bellboy while traveling in Japan in 1922 after he didn't have any cash to give him a tip. So he gave them a tip in a different way.
Here's your tip.
Yeah.
This is my secret to happiness.
He wrote on a note.
It's worth way more than a dollar.
He wrote, "A calm and modest life brings more happiness than the pursuit of success combined with constant restlessness."
Hmm. Well, I'm sure many would agree.
Yeah, and that's all he wrote.
Serenity. Serenity rocks.
Yeah, a calm and modest life. Mm-hmm. So Tuesday's bidding began at $2,000 and escalated, and it ended up getting $1.3
million. Wow. I wonder, was that the bellboy had that note? I mean, that's quite a tip.
Well, they don't say who actually has it now. I suspect it's changed a few hands.
I guess.
Over the years. 1922, Japanese bellboy. I don't know. That was kind of fun. The story I wanted to mention next was that a newly discovered moon tunnel has been revealed.
Oh.
It could be the perfect place for a moon colony.
There's a tunnel on the moon.
Yes, there is. Well, originally, when we went to the moon back in the 60s and 70s, a number of our Apollo scientists thought that because there seemed to have been active volcanoes on the moon, that there'd be lava tubes like we have in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And lava dunes would be the perfect place to put a base because it's protected from the radiation and the hot and cold of the outside of the surface weather.
And all those asteroids that bombard it.
Yeah, yeah, be more protected. So a lunar cave, lava cave, would be perfect, right? It'd be nice. And many scientists have thought, dreaming about this for a long time, and you've probably seen pictures of these, you know, underground bases in science fiction, but nothing's ever really come of it until recently when Japan's Kaiguya orbiter, which is their largest lunar mission ever for them. It's the largest one since the Apollo.
Don't you think
mission.
They'd have the emphasis on the first syllable?
Kaguya.
Kaguya.
Kaguya? K-A-G-U-Y-A?
Yeah, Kaguya. That sounds very Japanese to me. Kaguya.
It was launched in 2007 with all kinds of instruments, deployable satellites even, and a mission to solve the mystery of the moon's origin. Like, where did it come from? So in 2009, it took pictures of the Marias Hills, a large deep hole in the Marias Hills region of the moon. Now, holes aren't unusual, but a NASA lunar reconnaissance orbiter did a follow-up shot closer to the ground as a team of Japanese and American researchers investigated it. And the floor of the hole, from what they could see, extended several meters eastward and westward under a ceiling of two other holes, like the mouth of a tunnel. Okay, but that's all they had. They didn't know if the cave went on for miles or was it just a dead end or what. And it took several more years to find out. The Japanese got another assist when, in 2011, NASA put two spacecraft, the Gravity Recovery Ship and the Interior Laboratory Ship, up. They call it the GRAIL operation. Mm-hmm. GRAIL. Gravity Recovery Interior Laboratory. And GRAIL measured tiny fluctuations in the moon's gravity, and it mapped out the mountains and subterranean features of the moon. And so when it went over the Marias Hills, it detected something long and hollow beneath the surface. It went more than 30 miles.
Wow, that's quite a tunnel.
So the Japanese brought their probe back, and they blasted radar waves down on the suspected tunnel, and they listened for anomalies in the echoes that came back. And over again, they heard a very distinctive pattern of echoes. They think it's either the floor or the ceiling of a cave, the long, hoped-for lava tunnel. Hmm. Very long, 31 miles. It must be ancient, and it's buried under 300 feet below the surface. And it might even contain ice or water.
Hmm.
Right? So if they're correct, and it sounds a lot like what the old Apollo astronauts and scientists and hopeful colonists were looking for, then it's a place where we could actually have a really cool moon base.
All right. It sounds like as long as we don't mind taking elevators to the front door, we might have a possible real estate
option. Take an elevator down
here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of cool news in the space world.
Yeah, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Tunnel on the moon. Now we know where to get our adjacent plots of land.
That's
for
right.
Our suburban neighborhood.
Yeah. You can get your spot now. Also in space news, NASA gives the Dawn mission a second extension.
Okay, the Dawn.
The Dawn spacecraft? The Dawn spacecraft has been orbiting the dwarf planet Ceres since 2015. Ceres is a dwarf planet in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter.
Right.
And it's a very big asteroid.
Yeah, it's almost the size of Pluto, I think.
I think it's like 650 miles in diameter, something like that. But their mission extension will bring it right really close to the planet, down to less than 120 miles.
Isn't Ceres the one that has those two eyes that are like crystal eyes?
Yeah, that's right.
They're super shiny, and they think it might be reflective water.
Yeah, and they think it has a lot of ice on it, that many scientists now believe that Ceres may have more water on it than the Earth.
Hmm.
Yeah,
wow.
It's a very busy place.
Okay,
for
but
water.
Do they have beaches?
The beaches, I think, is a little cold for that. It's kind of frozen. But that's an interesting thing you mentioned that, Mrs. Future, because it is reaching its closest approach to the sun in its orbit around the solar system.
So if it did have a beach, now would be the time to be vacationing there in 2018.
Yeah, this is when you're more likely to see some action there. So as we watch Ceres as it heads towards what its closest point to the sun is called the perihelion.
Mm-hmm.
It'll give us an opportunity to learn about its super thin atmosphere also, because it has a very thin little transient atmosphere that comes up when it melts some of the ice on the planet.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about what kind of bathing suit you'd have to really enjoy the beaches on Ceres.
Well,
you probably have to have some kind of spacesuit.
Yeah, that'd probably be at least minus 100.
Right. So it would have to be thermal heated.
Warm.
You definitely probably wouldn't get a sunburn, but you might get a radiation burn.
It might get a little warmer than that with the atmosphere. We'll see. Anyway, there's more water in the atmosphere at that point. We'll find out. That's what they want to find out. They want to see how the atmosphere is affected by the sun as we get near it. Mm.
I hear that people are doing skin treatments now where they're freezing their skin. So maybe it'd be good for that kind of spa.
Yeah, if you can get out there. Yeah, they think the Ceres atmosphere is an effect of the solar activity rather than the dwarf planet's proximity to the sun, but they're not sure. So this will let us know that they theorize that energetic particles emitted by the sun during solar flares and coronal mass ejections hit the ice and transfer energy to water molecules, which causes them to sublimate, which creates a thin atmosphere. Hmm. So that's going on right now. They got an approval for this study, so we'll find out more about the Ceres atmosphere as the probe gets closer and watches
Dawn is already out there, and NASA decided to keep doing some science with it.
Yeah, it will not land or crash on the world. Because they might contaminate it.
Cassini.
Well, they don't want to do that because, you know, this is water, right? This is water.
Cassini didn't crash. Cassini burnt up in the atmosphere.
That's right, in the Jupiter. Mm-hmm. Or Saturn, that's right.
Yeah.
This they don't want to crash because they think that our probes have some microbes from Earth on them, little microbe bugs, and they might find Ceres very hospitable. They crash and we might infect Ceres with Earth life.
Oh, boy.
So we got to be really careful about that. So they don't
want to impregnate an asteroid.
No, you don't.
A dwarf planet.
Have microbial life.
Human life.
There.
How irresponsible.
Discovered new life and it turns out to be our own pollution. No, I don't want to do that. However, it'll be interesting to see how they adapt, but that's after it's been polluted. Meanwhile, we're going to try not to pollute it.
Okay.
All right. So.
And what's our strategy again? What are we doing?
Just get really close, low orbit, watch the atmosphere. Send in the probe, look at the atmosphere, and see what happens.
Send in the probe.
Yeah, see what we can find out.
Look around.
That's right.
That's what we do in space.
Probe
and look around.
Yeah.
Just about time for CBS and our middle of the hour break.
All right. So after the break, we'll talk more about other news. Some interesting news about self-driving cars coming out. They're evolving fast and furious, and I'll give you a couple of the headlines showing that and virtual reality and artificial intelligence stuff all coming up in the next half hour. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Okay, some other interesting news. Delphi buys the self-driving car startup Newtonomy for $450 million.
Okay, so
you heard of Delphi? Delphi is a company that usually does car parts.
Oh.
Right? So they've been very involved with self-driving research. They recently acquired Newtonomy, and they want to deploy it to their customers.
Okay, so they're going to now sell software as well as parts.
Under the deal, their autonomous driving team, Delphi's autonomous driving team, will double in size from about 200 people, including many new engineers and scientists that are highly sought after in this field. And Newtonomy, which was founded in 2013, probably funded then too, will continue to be based out of Boston. Mm-hmm. Okay, and once that's complete, then Delphi, they'll have autonomous driving operations in Boston, in Pittsburgh, in Singapore, Santa Monica, and Silicon Valley.
So what will they sell in those places? Are they going to convert cars to autonomous vehicles?
They seem to be working purely on the software side of things. Uh-huh. I think that's where they think their niche is in this. They, however, will have 60 self-driving cars on the road by the end of the year. And the goal is to further accelerate the global fleet expansion and technology department. So at least that's what they're saying in their press releases. Hmm. Now, this is kind of puzzling to some industry insiders because Delphi has been working on its own autonomous driving software created by another company called Automatica. Automatica. Mm-hmm. That was a Carnegie Mellon University spinoff. And they acquired Automatica back in 2015, Delphi.
Okay. So now they've got two autonomous car companies under their belt.
That's right.
Okay.
And their chief tech officer, Glenn DeVos, believes that having both of these software stacks will help the company more quickly deploy a system that meets the auto industry safety and driving performance requirements.
Oh, okay. So they're sort of trying to pick the blue chip innovations. They're trying to get ahead of the market.
Yeah, they want to be on top of the game there. Mm-hmm. They also are finding that by doing this, by buying this other company, they have access to some of the best minds doing research in this field, which is what they need at this point. Nutonomy is only 4 years old, but two of its founders, a guy named Carl Igamima and Emilio Frazzoli, they're hardly newcomers. Both of those guys have been working on this stuff since it was an academic exercise to race in the DARPA Grand Challenge back in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Been very involved with the autonomy that far back. Mm. So this is quite a big thing for Delphi to delve into. Mm. Originally, Nutonomy was founded to develop software for the vehicles. And its primary aim initially was to deploy a self-driving taxi fleet.
Mm-hmm.
They're also working with major automakers to deploy automated driving features in regular cars.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see more and more regular cars having more and more automated features.
That's what I thought, yeah, conversion kits.
Right? Yeah, or more and more capability mm-hmm. as time goes on. They don't have the visibility that Google or Uber or even Apple have in their pursuit of self-driving vehicles. However, they're the first to deploy a public trial, actually. The Delphi people, they actually launched a pilot program in Singapore as far back as August of last year
mm-hmm.
to test out these actual fleet of vehicles.
I see. And so a fleet means that they've got maybe a dozen?
Well, they're talking about 60.
60.
Around the world. Like mm-hmm. that's several fleets, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
They've never been interested in actually building the cars or the sensors for that matter. It's been pure software play for Delphi. So their success has been largely tied to their ability to land partnerships with automakers and other services like ride-hailing networks.
Mm-hmm. The Lyfts of the world or the Ubers.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And the company hasn't had a problem finding willing partners. They've been very successful with that. For example, they've worked with Peugeot. They partnered up in May with Nutonomy to test the self-driving cars in their Singapore project.
Mm-hmm.
And under that project, they're installing sensors and software into the Peugeot 3008 models.
Okay.
Which is part of a plan to develop the large fleet of autonomous cars.
Hmm.
And they've announced a partnership with Lyft this summer.
Oh.
Yeah, to bring autonomous cars into the network. They're rolling out a limited pilot program where Lyft users will be able to hail a self-driving car from an app.
Huh. Where are they doing that? Is that going to be in Boston?
Well, Silicon Valley. They have
here.
Yeah, they have a whole element here. So as to where in Silicon Valley exactly, we'll find out.
So will the autonomous fleet get their own button on the app? Like, click here if you want an autonomous car?
Don't want a human driver? Click here.
Right.
I wonder if it'd be cheaper.
I wonder if they're going to be subjected to the same rating system. Are you going to be able to say if you like your autonomous car or driver?
Well, my robot wasn't very good in conversation, but he drove well.
My robot was driving too slow.
He ratted on me when I lit up in the back seat. Oh, hate those robots.
Well, do robots take feedback very well when they're driving your car? Probably not.
Positive reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
They'll take compliments, but not abuse.
Yeah, no, I don't think they'll take abuse. Remember, they're working on this whole abuse issue because they're worried with the autonomous cars that, like, New Yorkers will abuse autonomous cars because they're very polite. You know, they obey the rules.
No, it was in Philadelphia where that hitchhiking robot disappeared.
That's true. Philadelphia is second only to New York in terms of strangeness of rude drivers.
Abusive machines.
They have to design a special New York mode. For example, they've now created it so that the autonomous cars now slowly move up at a four-way stop sign. You know, when four people are trying to decide who's going to go next, the cars now inch forward a little more aggressively than they did in the older software.
Oh, really? They used to be like, oh, no, you first.
Yes,
please,
yes,
you,
and everyone
please,
just took advantage of them.
Uh-huh.
You know, the autonomous car is sitting there while everyone else is going.
So at a normal stop sign, everybody else gets through in 1 minute, and
the autonomous car
a half an hour.
Yeah, they realize that's not good.
That's too polite.
Yeah.
We need more aggression in these vehicles.
They do. So, especially when you're trying to combine them with humans. It's another story when you try to have roads just for the autonomous cars. And there are people that are working on that scenario as well. The HOV lanes.
HOV lanes. Do we have some of those?
Over the Valley and East Bay, you do. Those are like commuter lanes. They're going to go more towards autonomy.
What does HOV stand for? Something only vehicles. Probably.
Yeah, I'm not sure what HOV stands for, Mrs. Future.
Well, I've just never heard the term before.
I've seen those too. Oh, here it is. High occupancy vehicle lane.
Oh, HOV lane.
Okay. Carpool lane. Diamond lane. Transit lane.
I knew what you meant. I just thought maybe it had
restricted
something to
traffic
do with
lane.
Autonomous cars.
No, they're not yet, but but they're being looked at as a place to test autonomous cars.
I got it.
So that was kind of interesting, I thought.
Yeah.
It's a sign that maybe it's time for us to begin to get used to seeing them on the road. And there's another link that I have on that. It was an interesting Wired article called, Maybe It's Time to Cede U.S. Freeways to Driverless Cars.
This is really remarkable. Talk about the pace of innovation.
Way faster than we thought.
So we had the DARPA challenge happening in 2004, and here it is, 2017, and we're talking about turning autonomous cars loose on our freeways and dedicating freeways to them. That's less than one generation.
I know, right? Oh, Gregory texts in, what happens if you give an autonomous car the finger?
I'm sure no one cares, except you, maybe.
It records your picture.
There you go. You get a bad customer rating, and it is very slow to come and get you in the next time.
It will bypass you the next time you want one.
Right. If you hail a cab, it will say, sorry, I'm not taking you. Autonomous cars with attitude.
Yes. Well, they do. They have to create attitude in these vehicles. That's the challenge. How to create the right attitude for the right environment. Mm-hmm. Like if you go to New Delhi or something like that, you have very different traffic rules than in New York.
Sure. Oh, and imagine if an autonomous car was getting, say, spray painted by a vandal. Maybe it should have some kind of appropriate behavior to dissuade a person from doing that to them. Like maybe it should spray paint them back or something. Reciprocity.
Yeah. I mean, we have to think about these things. Electrify the hull so that people get electric shocks if you try to mess with the machine.
Do you remember Steve Roberts, the bicycle nomad?
Yes, yeah. He had a warning system on his bicycle that warned you if you got too close to it.
His vehicle spoke to you and said that it was notifying the owner of your presence.
Yeah.
And just gave you the sense that you were going to get caught if you acted like no one was watching.
Yes, I am taking your picture and notifying the owner that you are looking at me. Strangely.
Right.
All these things and more will be thought of before we're done with this stuff, I'll tell you that.
Hey, we got a phone call from Billy Sunshine.
Oh, okay, let's talk to Billy for a second.
Hey, yeah. Billy, welcome.
Big hits.
Hey.
Before the break here, we got a quick moment for you.
Yeah, you going to drive an autonomous car? Would you drive in one?
Oh, absolutely. What I was thinking of, because I'm from Philadelphia, how to solve the problem of the vandalism. Yeah. And it's really easy.
Yeah.
First of all, to get an autonomous car, they have to know who you are, right?
Yeah.
It can also take your picture. And third of all, if you actually start to abuse the car locks you in and drives directly to the automated police station.
There you go. You go to detention. You go to passenger detention.
You sure do. You go right to jail.
Careful what you wish for, Billy. I do not want cars to think that they have more privileges than people. I do not want them in charge of people where we have no ability to say no. I think cars should always do what the people ask them to do. And
including
never
be willing to get
to
abused?
Do what they don't want to do.
Well, abuse is difficult topic.
Yeah. No, I don't think that abuse is the criteria.
Asimov's rules of robots say the first rule, of course, is you cannot harm a human being or let a human being become harmed.
Yeah.
But the fourth rule is you can't allow yourself to be harmed either unless it means harming a human being.
Yeah, good point.
All right, well, there's more to talk about this after the break. So,
all right, guys.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye, Billy.
Thanks, Billy.
Colin. Dr. Future Show. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. This next article, we're going to go over a little bit before our guest comes on AI, because it's important to recognize this is a breakthrough in the AI world. As the article, Mrs. Future, on how AlphaGo Zero shows that machines can become superhuman without any help from humans.
Yes, in theory. People in the field think this is a huge moment, kind of like Skynet going sentient.
What's interesting about AlphaGo was that the first version of AlphaGo did beat the top Go player last year.
Yeah, we covered that.
And that was more of a classic AI story where the AI studied thousands and thousands of games and really learned the strategies of the masters and then applied them in beating a human Go
master.
And
it had a whole history of not winning and then learning, and then finally it could beat the best player in the world. So it had a very human-like period of
training.
And
that's how humans learn. They study under masters and learn more that way, that kind of thing. What's unique about the new program is that it's a machine that figured out how to play Go without studying anything.
No, it figured out how to win at Go. It was given the rules and the goal.
Yeah, it was the rules and the goal, but it hadn't studied any of the other games, right, or strategies or that sort of thing. It learned on its own. The techniques.
Trial and error.
Right. And it did that to build up its own understanding of how the game worked. Mm-hmm. It discovered many of the tricks and techniques that human Go players had developed over the last several thousand years. After just a few days in, it rediscovered the best known plays. And then in the final days, it went beyond those plays to find something even better. It was quite cool to watch, according to the researchers, observing its learning process. This was done by DeepMind in London, which was acquired by Google in 2014. And that company is focused on making big strides in AI using gameplay, simulation, and machine learning. And they've literally hired hundreds of AI researchers pursuing that goal. This particular project, the AlphaGo Zero, involved about 15 people and millions of dollars of computing resources. So both AlphaGo and AlphaGo Zero use machine learning approaches known as reinforcement learning. Reinforcement learning.
Reinforcement means that you keep trying until you get it right. And you optimize your behavior as you learn.
As well as deep neural networks.
Let's see. What does that tell us? I guess we're going to have to ask our guest what deep neural networks tells us.
But to reiterate, reinforcement learning is inspired by the way animals seem to learn through experimentation and feedback. And DeepMind use those techniques to get a superhuman performance in simpler Atari games. But mastering Go was particularly significant, however, because it's complex and the best players make their moves instinctively. The rules of good play can't be easily expressed in code. And that just was hard to write the code for Go. And reinforcement learning shows promise for automating the programs of machines in many other contexts, including how they would be impractical to program them by hand. It's already being tested for teaching robots to grasp awkward objects and as a means of conserving energy in data centers by reconfiguring hardware on the fly. And it's been very, very helpful. By not using human data or human expertise, they've actually removed the constraints of human knowledge. And they're able to create knowledge for itself based on first principles of how things actually work. To achieve Go supremacy, AlphaGo Zero simply played against itself. Randomly at first, like the original, it used a deep neural network and then a powerful search algorithm to pick its next move. But in AlphaGo Zero, a single neural network took care of those functions.
Well, it's sort of babbledygook talking about it without really being clear what the AI is being asked to do and what is really happening here. It seems to me that what we're saying is that if you give a computer one simple task, and you give it all the time in the world to do that one simple task over and over and over again and tell it to keep score, and after it does that one simple task over and over again and keeps score, to repeat the ones that win and to discard the ones that lose. And therefore, you keep stacking the deck in favor of those strategies that win. And you have given this AI something that never happens to a human. You've given it a very clear and specific goal. You've given it very clear parameters of how to get to that goal. And you've given it a lot of time to try different possibilities. So for us to talk about this as a breakthrough in real intelligence is really overselling it, I think. It is a breakthrough in seeing that a machine can derive a behavior
from its own experience rather than from what others have told it. So it's self-learning, which
is... It has a goal of following the rules to win this game. So just by setting up the expectation, you've already intervened. You've given it a human expectation. You've said, machine, do this. So I would say that this experiment shows much more, instead of saying that this shows what happens when AIs don't need their humans anymore. In fact, what it shows is that AIs are going to be programmed to become very efficient at whatever goals humans give them. So that's what this says to me. And I think that people who are framing it the other way are misconstruing the significance here.
Well, it would be nice if it could learn to be as good a Go player as it could with just the knowledge of a Go master. A Go master plays several thousand games and becomes an expert. And the computer still has to play millions of games to reach that same level of mastery. Master only takes a few thousand. Why is the humans learning with a few thousand times rather than millions? Mm-hmm. So there's some kind of difference in style and strategy that the humans are doing that is still way more efficient than the machine. Mm-hmm. It's just that the machine does have the speed to do millions of iterations.
Yeah, well, the human probably has some kind of algorithm that the machine hasn't been able to discover yet that allows them to optimize their instincts.
Yeah, that'll be something to discover what that human strategy might be.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's very interesting stuff to see how these little baby steps in understanding logic, really. With computers, what you're talking about is logic and speed. And those aspects of human intelligence can be optimized, for sure.
Yeah.
And that's why machines are so scary, because if you need to do something that isn't logical and the machine hasn't been given an ability to either interact with someone who's giving it new information or to stop its program, then you're dealing with where something stupid is in charge of something intelligent, and the intelligent being that has a myriad of more options to pursue can't stop the thing that is just programmed to do that very specific task. That's the fear.
Well, we'll talk to Dr. Ming about that in the second hour and get some more detail. Meanwhile, I wanted to mention a couple other things before we go here.
Okay.
One I thought was very, very interesting in Kurzweil, Accelerating Intelligence. It was an article on a self-assembling bacteria controlled by a synthetic gene circuit. A self-assembling bacteria builds working electronic sensors. This is a self-assembling bacteria building useful electronic devices. This was a first.
Yeah.
So we're actually having biological organisms building us electronics.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Other experiments have grown materials using biological processes, like biofilms. But to actually build an electronic circuit, this is a new study that has shown that programming cells is now possible. And as a demonstration, bacteria were programmed to assemble into a finger pressure sensor. So they built a finger pressure sensor to detecting pressure.
Mm-hmm.
When you push down a button, they built a button. Push this button.
Uh-huh.
The functional device from a single cell. Isn't that amazing? So that's an example of how our engineering is beginning to combine with nature to create living electronic systems. It's a new field called living electronics.
Living electronics, making do with nano circuits, like electron level circuits.
Yes, yes. Very interesting article, self-assembling materials, very exciting work. Synthetic biologists are way into this, and they're looking at making more and more complex things all the time. One of the chief engineering folks there is a guy named Ling Chong Yu, who says, quote, "Nature is a master of fabricating structured materials consisting of living and non-living components. But it is extraordinarily difficult to program nature to create self-organized patterns. This work, however, is a proof of principle that it is not impossible." So soon we'll be having nature grow our technologies. Isn't that wild?
Coming right up.
Yeah.
Boy, the future is going to be really different than the past. That's for sure.
It's just the beginning for what's possible. We'll see you after the break with Dr. Vivian Ming. After the news break, news, weather, sports, and all that good stuff.
All right, this is the Dr. Future Show on KSEO Santa Cruz. Stay tuned for the second hour after the news, traffic, weather. Dave Michaels will be back.